Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the Book of Psalms. We left off at Psalm 90 is where we left off. So I just want to get right into it because we're running a little late here. It says in verse 1 of Psalm 90, it says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations before the mountains were born. Or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man back into dust and say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In the morning they are like the grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew. Towards evening it fades and withers away. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do return, O Lord, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants. O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days you have afflicted us, and the years that we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants, and your majesty to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. I just want to read this whole thing, because I didn't want to break up this theme that's here. But let's just go back and break it down, because it really does say a lot. It says a lot about, well, the curse that we're under, for one thing. It says an awful lot about life and death and dying and meaning and purpose. It really does. It recovers a lot of ground. It says in this verse 1, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Now, I mean, what is a dwelling place? I mean, it's a place where people, you know, they abide, they lodge. It's a place where people inhabit, or they pitch their tent, right? It's almost like, it's easy to read this, but we got to, I think, really take inventory in regards to what this means in our own life. Because it said, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Now, here's the thing. Today, you can almost say, the TV has been my dwelling place from year to year, or the computer, or the cell phone. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I really think that we have to take inventory and say, okay, do we really seek out God on a daily basis? I mean, to touch Him in terms of prime time, quality time, time alone with Him, where it's just Him and you, or Him and me, in terms of touching Him with our spirit and being touched by Him with His spirit. And I tell you what, there's really no, I think, more satisfying experience in life, or sweet experience, when we are right with God, and then we can get alone in His presence. And just sometimes, you know, I found myself in situations where I don't even know what to say to God. I just sit there in the peace, just in His presence, you know. I just feel like I don't even have a lot of energy to even pray. You know what I'm saying? I don't have a big burden on me, but it's just sitting in His presence. It's like, sometimes it's just so peaceful. It's like, man, I don't want to leave here. And, you know, we got to ask ourselves, do we seek out God in that way? Because I think if we do, it says that, well, He's really a priority in our life. And I think that's what that's saying. It's not saying that everybody, when it says this in that verse 1, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. It's not saying that everybody in every generation that this applies to, because it doesn't. I would say this, that it's only a remnant in every generation that this applies to. And in verse 2 it says, before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Now, just that in alone, I feel like you could write volumes about that, because it says, before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world. Now, here's the thing. It's making abundantly clear here that God is the prime mover behind this universe and behind our solar system, behind our world. But we are so dumbed down today. We are being so brainwashed from I don't know, just from kindergarten, from grade school to grad school, what are we being fed? All this nonsense that, you know what, we just all evolved out of this big bang 15 billion years ago, and we've all just all evolved from the zoo. But you know what? In the book of Revelation, when God is bringing judgment after judgment after judgment after judgment upon this world because of all mankind's wickedness, twice in the book of Revelation, it really emphasizes the fact that, you know what, God is the creator of all things. We have so crowded him out of the equation that now we just believe we came from monkeys or apes or this type of thing. But what it says in Revelation chapter 5, when it's talking about how John sees God upon the throne, and all of the elders and the angels are saying this: "Worthy are you, O Lord and our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and because of your will they existed and were created." Now, that really emphasizes something here. Mm-hmm. Things just didn't come into this world, I mean, this universe or this cosmos by happenstance, right? I mean, you got to really be certifiable, in my opinion, if you really believe that. I mean it. I mean it. You really got to be.
Well,
you
the
know,
thing is, they're teaching it in the school.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
They're growing up hearing that from their educators.
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. That's why I think in the book of Revelation, God is really emphasizing this, because in the 10th chapter of the book of Revelation, we read about this angel, this mighty angel, who I believe is none other than Michael the Archangel. Mm-hmm. And it says he's got 1 foot planted on the sea and 1 foot planted on the earth. And it says that he's clothed in a cloud. He's got a rainbow around his head, and his legs, his feet are on fire. He's holding a book, all right, a scroll, and he's swearing by him who lives in heaven. He says this: "The angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land lifted up his right hand to heaven, and he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created the heaven and the things in it, and the earth and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, that there will be delay no longer," in terms of, you know, God's judgments and Christ's return. But it's almost like God has to emphasize this. All right, this angel comes down and he swears by the one in heaven who created all these things, right? Because we have been so dumbed down with all this politically correct baloney. To me, Darwinism has just been a curse, just a scourge on humanity. It really has. And, you know, when we read something like this in verse 2 of Psalm 90, "Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." Now, interesting thing, that word "everlasting to everlasting," that means that he's eternal. Yep. There's no getting around that. And I think it's kind of interesting that Micah says this in regards to the birth of Christ. He said this in Micah chapter 5. He says, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrata, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for my people to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." Some Bibles say from everlasting to everlasting. And that term that Micah used, from everlasting to everlasting, it really means beyond the vanishing point. In other words, I've said before, if you look down a long straight road or a long, you know, railroad track, there comes a point when you're looking down at this road or this railroad track where it just comes to a point and vanishes. The vanishing point. And the words that Micah is using here in regards to everlasting, it means literally beyond the vanishing point. Mm-hmm. And if you could take in your mind, if you could go into the future as far as you possibly can, I don't care whether it's in heaven, whether it's in an eternal state, whether it's a millennial state, whatever it is, however far your mind can go, it comes to a point where it just vanishes. Your mind can't go any further than that. And then if you go back in the past, it's the same thing. Go back as far as you possibly can in your mind in terms of before God created the universe, before he created the angels, before, and there comes a point where it just vanishes. Well, that's describing Jesus Christ. This is describing God in terms of being everlasting to everlasting. And, you know, when Jesus Christ referred to himself in the book of Revelation as being the Alpha and the Omega, meaning I'm the beginning and I'm the end. Before me, there's nothing. After me, there's nothing. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the A to the Z. All right? That, to me, is mind-boggling. It really is. But, you know, we can read something like this Psalm 90 in that verse 2 and just go over our heads. And I think that we have to take a good look at it, a hard look at it, a deep look at it, because everybody today is just being so brainwashed with such stupidity. It's just, it would be hilarious if it wasn't so tragic. It really would. Right? That people, you know, will not give God the credit, not give God the glory, not give him the honor, not give him the time of day. But we are told very clearly in Romans that when people do this, God just gives them over to a depraved mind, and they begin to act more and more wickedly. That's all there is to it. When we replace the Creator with the creature. And he says this in verse 3, you turn man back to dust and say, return, O children of men. Now, here's another thing. God said this to who?
Adam.
He said it to Adam, all right? When it says here, you turn man back into dust and say, return, O children of men. It didn't say, you turn man back to the zoo, you know, where he came from. No, he turns him back to dust. And we are told very clearly in Genesis chapter 3 that God, when he cursed the ground because of Adam, he just said this, by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. It's exactly what people are going to turn into is dust. And God put this whole concept of death into motion because of man's rebellion. But that's what it means when it says in verse 3, you turn back man into dust and say, return, O children of men. And the death rate is still one per person. Nobody can get out of it. You know, there's no getting out of it, right? You know, no, there's no exceptions. I know when you're young and you're dumb and you feel like you're immortal, or, you know, you just assume that you're going to live forever. You think that, well, when it comes to death or dying, there's going to be an exception in my case. Well, there is no exceptions. And he says this in verse 4 of Psalm 90, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. Now, here's the thing people have to understand, because Peter said something very similar to that in 2 Peter chapter 3, where he just said 1,000 years is but a day to the Lord, and a day is but 1,000 years. And so many people have just tortured what Peter said there to mean that, well, you know, it wasn't a literal 24-hour period where God created, you know, things. In other words, a six-day period, a 24-hour period, because he says, you know, a day is but 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is but a day. But what did Peter mean when he said that?
Time is irrelevant.
Time is totally and completely irrelevant to God, because time is a creation of God himself. Right? And time will end. But this whole universe is folded up like a garment and discarded. It's going to flee from the face of him who sits upon the throne. And then time will cease. Eternity will be all that exists. Yeah. But what are we told when God created the universe? He says, there was evening, there was morning the first day. Evening, morning the second day. Evening, morning the third day. Well, in the eternal state, there's no night. There's no evening.
All day.
It's all eternal, right? And then he says this in verse 5. Says, you have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep in the morning and are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew. Towards evening it fades and withers away. Now look at this. In verse 5 it says, you have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In other words, all men die. They're swept away like a flood. They're here today, they're gone tomorrow, right? They fall asleep. That's what that means. That's talking about death, all right? And he says, in the morning they are like the grass which sprouts, and in the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew. Towards evening it fades and withers away. Now, this is kind of interesting, because in that verse 5, in the morning they are like grass which sprouts anew. Meaning what?
Young, vigorous.
Fades.
Yeah.
Say that again?
In the morning. In other words, when you come into this world, you're new, you're fresh, I mean, you got your life before you. But also, put it this way, because he was just talking about return all men to dust. Well, when you return to dust, what happens with that dust? Your decomposed body, all of a sudden, it starts sprouting up daisies, right? Right? I mean, that's what the saying is. It says, you have swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In the morning, they are like grass which sprouts anew. Right? In the morning, it flourishes and sprouts anew. Towards evening, it fades and withers away. There you go, see? Mm. And then verse 4 says, for we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins, in the light of your presence. Now, here's the thing. People have to put this in the context of all other scripture, because when we are right with God, when our sins are forgiven, he removes our sins from him as far as the east is from the west. It's like being buried in the depths of the sea. But the very fact that, you know, we all are under this curse of death shows that, you know, this is all the result of our rebellion against him. And then he says this, "For all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years with like a sigh." How many times have you seen people who are on their deathbed, especially elderly people, don't they finish their days with a sigh? You know, it's pretty sad. You can hear the death rattle, that gurgling sound as the hours approach or the minutes approach before they finally give up their spirit with a sigh. And he says in this verse 10, "As for the days for our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, and soon it is gone, and we fly away." Now, what is that saying? What does that mean? Because to me, that is really powerful. Mm-hmm. What is this?
Well,
depressing. Well, so, you know.
That we're going to live 70 or 80 years, and then we're going to be miserable.
Well,
there's
someplace else in Scripture that says a man's days will be 120 days.
No, that was...
That's
in Genesis, when God was going to bring the flood. He said, "My spirit will not always strive with men, but nevertheless..." His years should be 120 years, meaning this.
Yeah.
And when he told Noah to start building the ark, he said, "I'm going to give man 120 years to repent."
Oh, okay, I get it.
That was it. "My spirit will not always strive with men, but I'm going to give him 120 years. And if he doesn't repent in there, man, bam, and the flood's coming," right? Okay.
Back then, men lived hundreds of years.
But now, here's the thing. We're talking about here, where it says this. Well, we just read in Psalm 90, where he said this, "As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Now, interesting thing. In all the advanced, let's just say, nations on the earth in terms of their pharmaceuticals and medical advances and all these other things, the average lifespan is still hovering between 70 and 80 years old. Mm-hmm. It really is. And then if you include the entire population of the earth, well, now it really drops dramatically, all right, mm-hmm. as far as the mortality years of men. But he says this, "As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow." Meaning what?
With their pride?
Yes. "Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow." I think, Isla, you said it.
That we live 80 years and we're miserable?
Yeah, because what it's saying is, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, meaning this, even the best of these years are often filled with emptiness and pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, mine says, yet the best of them, meaning the years, the best of them are but trouble and sorrow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Now isn't that a depressing picture?
It is depressing.
Well, hey, take a look at life. I think it was in a Reader's Digest, a few years back, I read this article that says that the average person can't go more than 2 weeks without being hit upside the head with something. I don't care whether it's an illness, whether it's a car repair, whether it's some kind of crisis, mm-hmm. something happening, a financial setback. You know, I can't seem to go 2 days without being slapped upside the head with something. This is just the world we live in. Yeah, right. This is what he's talking about here. But now, here's the thing that people have to understand. When it says 70 years are given man because of strength, you know, some may live to be 80. But in Psalm 139, this is what God said. He says, "I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth." Now, the psalmist is saying this, that God formed him mm-hmm. in his mother's womb, but he this is the way he words it. "When I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth." Now, why didn't he say in the depths of the womb?
Well, mankind came from the depths of the earth.
From the ground. Because that's what he comes from, the ground. He says, "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance in the womb. And in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." Now, it's saying this, that God has determined ahead of time, "I'm going to give you X number of years, days, months, weeks, minutes, seconds. That's what I'm giving you." But now look what we're doing. We are playing God, aren't we, now? We just passed in this California this is another law in terms of promoting this, assisted suicide. And I'm telling you, this is what we got to focus in on in terms of what God is saying here in His Word. All right? He's saying 70 years are given man because of strength. Some may live to be 80. And in Psalm 139, 39, it says, hey man, God has written all the days that he has ordained for us in his book. Now, we can cut those days short. I don't care through, you know, just being rebellious and disobedient or just suicide. And I'm telling you, this whole concept of mercy killing, as a matter of fact, I'm writing a chapter right now called Mercy Has Become a Mass Murderer. And let me ask you something, just to throw this out here. Since we're talking about death and dying and God giving us X number of years and X number of days, who was executed in the Bible for assisting suicide? For mercy killing?
Wasn't someone supposed to kill Saul and he didn't?
Very good. It was
supposed to kill Saul.
It's 1 Samuel, the last chapter, as well as 2 Samuel, the first chapter. We just read about a situation there where Saul was wounded in battle. And then he told his armor bearer, man, the Philistines are going to get to me, so run me through with your sword. But his armor bearer wouldn't do it, right? Instead, his armor bearer, you know, fell on his own sword and killed himself, right? And so Saul had fallen on his sword trying to kill himself, and he didn't succeed. So he comes to, and then he sees this Amalekite running by, calls out to him, and says, hey, run me through before these Philistines make sport of me. So the Amalekite, you know, said, okay, you know, the guy's dying, I'll put him out of his misery. And so he killed him, right? And then he took his crown, he took his armband, and then this Amalekite went to David and told David, well, you know, the Philistines have won the day, and Saul and his sons were killed. And he says, well, how do you know Saul's dead? And so he told him. He says, well, I went by him and he asked me to, you know, to finish him off, so I did out of mercy. And then David says, well, you just killed the Lord's anointed. He had the guy executed right there.
Yeah.
Now, see, that was a mercy killing, wasn't it? It was a mercy killing. It was an assisted suicide. And how did God look at that? You just took a life. Therefore, you're going to pay with your own.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm telling you, we are on a collision course with judgment. We really are. Now, here's the thing, man. I think that we have so many technological advances, especially in our pharmaceutical area, in terms of if a person, you know, is dying of something very painful like cancer, it's an act of mercy to try to alleviate their pain, you know, through medication,
mm-hmm.
even if they're kind of out of it. That, to me, is perfectly legitimate. I mean, nobody likes to see even a dog suffer, let alone, you know a human being.
Yeah.
But we're not in a position to say, well, you know what, I'm a compassionate person, I'm a merciful person, so I'm just going to put this person down. Because I'm telling you, once you're on that road now where does it stop?
Yeah.
You know, because you can see it. We've opened this Pandora's box, and now people who don't even have terminal illnesses or diseases are now being put down. People who are depressed, people who are lonely, people, you know, just throw it out there. Well, I got news for people. There's coming a judgment upon this world that is so unique. It is so incredibly unique. It's never, ever been heard of before. And this judgment that's coming upon the world is when death flees from men.
Right.
And this is what it says in Revelation chapter 9 when it describes how God as a judgment allows, you know, these demonic creatures to be let out of hell, and I don't believe anybody sees them, but they spread some kind of disease or pandemic among men who do not, excuse me, they're not sealed on their forehead with God's name. These people are open season for these demonic creatures. And even though men don't see them, people say, well, that's all baloney. Devil can't spread disease. Give me an example where devils, you know, made a person sick. How about Job?
Oh, yeah.
He trusts Job, and look what Satan did to Job. All right? Jesus Christ talked about a woman who had been bound by Satan for 18 years. Remember that situation? She came into a synagogue, and Jesus healed this woman. And then, of course, the religious leaders got very indignant because it happened to be a Sabbath. You know? And he says, hey, which one of you phonies wouldn't help a dumb animal out of a pit on a Sabbath day? And this woman has been bound by Satan for 18 years. Now, whatever caused that Satan to be able to do that to that woman, I can only speculate that she probably was dabbling into some kind of occultic practice, and then God just allowed this judgment to come in her life. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the devil can bring physical sickness upon people, but this is what's going to happen When these demonic creatures are let loose, this is what it says in Revelation chapter 9. He says, then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit like a smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Now, I believe what's going to happen here. This is speculative, but I believe this is what's going to happen. As a judgment against mankind, because they will not listen to God when it comes to, you know, when God says, stay away from demons, don't have anything to do with demons, stay away from all these occultic practices and Satan worship and conjuring up the dead and all these things, all right? Men won't listen to God. Men are up to their eyeballs in occultic practices and all kinds of voodoo and witchcraft and sorcery and all these type of things. So God's saying, okay, you want demons? I'll give you demons. This is the worst kind of demons, right? So Satan's given this key, and he lets these creatures out. Nobody sees them because they're in the spirit realm, all right? But I do believe what they will see is a super volcano, a massive volcano, because it does say this. He opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit, and like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and the power was given to them, as scorpions of the earth have power. And they were told not to hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only the men who did not have the seal of God on their forehead. And they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. And then, listen to this, and in those days, men will seek death and will not find it. And they will long to die, and death will flee from them. I'm going to repeat that, because I believe that that is God's judgment against man trying to play God when it comes to assisted suicide. I really do believe that this is a poetic justice from God, where it says this, in those days men will seek death and will not find it, and they will long to die, but death will flee from them. Is that a unique judgment?
Oh, yeah.
That is truly unique. And you got to ask, well, why would God allow such a thing? And you got to say, well, good, just back it up here. Just back it up to where we're going with all of this quote-unquote mercy killing. We're talking about death. We're talking about dying. We're talking about life. We're talking about meaning. We're talking about purpose. And this is the thing that people have to just take deadly serious, man, that God is the author of life, and we have no right to, you know, push him aside and say, well, no, I'm going to decide when I die, or I'm going to have somebody else decide for me when I'm going to die. Because that is truly out of the pit of hell. Because if you read this Psalm 90 that we're in, look at that verse. Well, just back up to that verse 10. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years, yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. In other words, even the best of the years are just filled with emptiness and pain. For soon it is gone, and we fly away. In other words, how old are you? You don't have to tell me, but I'll tell you what. Here's the thing. The older we get, I mean, isn't it amazing? I mean, it's almost like every morning I get up and say, man, where did the day go? You know, the day before. It's kind of like, you get up another day, and then next thing you know, another day goes by, another week goes by, another month goes by, another year goes by, then a decade goes by, and then everything's going by so quick, and your life is going quick, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. It's like, man, it's just flying away. That's what it said right here. For soon it is gone, and we fly away. You know what I mean? We don't go back to the zoo, believe me. Our soul goes where? It says that in Ecclesiastes that our body goes to the ground, but our soul returns to the one who gave it. And it says in verse 11, who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? In other words, we really need to fear God, and it doesn't mean we run around like Chicken Little screaming as the sky is falling. What it means is we realize, you know what, I have to account to God. I have to account to God for my life, so I'm going to live my life accordingly. All right? So look at that verse 12. So teach us to number our days. Right? That's what we have to do. Rather than, well, what are we doing? We're shortening our days if we don't like being around. Right? But what we really need to do, it says, teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. That's what we need to do. Rather than, well, I'm going to avoid this pain, so I'm just going to end my life, have somebody end it for me. No. He says that we need to number our days. God's numbered our days. He's given us X number of days, but we need to figure out, okay, how many days do I have? How many years do I have? How much time do I have left? Because Jesus Christ himself said that I must work the works of him who sent me while there is still day, because night is coming when no man can work. And the same thing applies to all Christians
the night is coming when no man can work. And I do believe this is this to be true. I believe that one of the sins that's going to loom the largest on Judgment Day are the sins of omission. Just simply, when we had opportunity to do good, to honor God, to glorify Him some way, we just said to heck with it, you know, and it did nothing. Take a look at the rich man who ends up in hell that Jesus Christ described in Luke chapter 16. There's no indication whatsoever that this rich man was a wicked man. There's nothing in that context that Jesus Christ described this man to suggest that this man was just vile. He was an evil, worthless, good-for-nothing scum, that he was just a monster of iniquity, that he was just a wicked, evildoer. There's nothing to indicate that at all, is there? But how did he spend his day? Totally self-absorbed, totally could care less about this sick, dying man at his gate, the front of his gate. All right, he just ate sumptuously every day, dressed in all these fine clothing, and it just was completely self-absorbed, right? And now he ends up in hell. So what it's saying here, verse 12, so teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Verse 13, do return, O Lord, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants. O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days that you have afflicted us and the years that we have seen evil. And just keep this in mind. You know, very often in this short period of time that we have on this planet, God will oftentimes bring a lot of sorrow and grief and setbacks and disappointments and heartbreaks into our lives, because it's His way of fashioning us and shaping us and molding us, all right, and maturing us and, you know, fashioning us into images of His Son. And that's not an easy thing. But at the same token, a lot of times, suffering draws us close to God, all right? And look at the rich man. It appears that he just spent his life, you know, just having a grand old time. And he could give, you know, couldn't give a second thought about God. But I think had his life been characterized more like Lazarus, he'd probably be in heaven today, simply because his misfortunes would have driven to his knees, more than likely. Not guaranteed, but there would be a good, much better chance. And then in verse 14, he says, verse 16, he says, let your work appear to your servants and your majesty to their children. In other words, he's talking about God's work of grace, His work of blessing, all right, to be bestowed upon people who have given their life to Him or committed to Him, you know, who are giving to Him a heart of wisdom in terms of living for Him. But he also says this, and your majesty to their children. Because, you know, it says in the book of Proverbs that the glory of young men or the glory of men is their fathers. Mm-hmm. You know, and you would almost think it would read just the opposite. The glory of fathers is their sons. But it says just the opposite. Mm-hmm. The glory of sons is their father. Meaning what?
The father meaning raises that if you, them correctly.
Sorry.
Yeah, and what were you going to say?
That if you raise up your child, that if the fathers raise up their child, in the house of God.
Yeah. See, that's exactly what it's saying. In other words, you know, if you have a father that is really investing himself into his child's life, especially spiritually, he's raising up his children in a love and a knowledge and a fear of God, all right, then that's really, really the son's glory is their father. But here's the thing, too. We are told very clearly in Exodus that God says He's a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the second and third generation. Now, what does that mean?
Ungodliness will go forward in the next generation of...
Well, he visits the iniquity, and people who are not thinking clearly will find fault with God with this. But, you know, it's just as night follows day, all it is reaping what you sow. In other words, if you have a father that's a pathological liar, that's a thief, that's a criminal, that's into drugs, that's in all kinds of illegal activity, all right, that cusses and swears, he's into all this kind of stuff, what do you think his children are going to be like?
Like him.
Yeah, because it's just, you know, like father, like son, you know, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree, you know, whatever the thing you can come up with. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that. So you can't blame God for that.
But you can thank him when he intervenes.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. It can happen. It happens. Yeah. Right. But it, you know, when you have a godly father, it's usually, you know, he's gonna, you know, the greatest legacy that any man could pass on to his children is not a huge monetary inheritance, but rather a saving knowledge of God in their life. And, you know, so it says, let your, verse 16, let your work appear to your servants and your majesty to their children, you know, that they can see what? His blessing in their life. And verse 17, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands. Now, what does that mean?
He blesses our efforts.
Huh? Well, yes. When he says this, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, all right? Mm-hmm. In other words, his grace be upon us, his undeserved favor, but when it says confirm for us the work of our hands. The work of our hands, in other words, that he's going to bless what we do, mm-hmm. and it's going to confirm it by his success. I personally look at this, and I, you know, I can't help but think of, you know, I hope he's going to confirm the work of my hands when it comes to, you know, just the, you know, pouring my heart out for, you know, all these years trying to, you know, to serve him, you know, because it's going to be a real bummer if I just feel like, man, I got nothing to show for it at the end, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, so it says, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and confirm for us the work of our hands. Anybody have anything to add or share to what we read?
No.